Now, those of you who've been around the last few Sundays, you'll have been here when we've been talking about these miraculous signs out of the Gospel of John. And it's been a great series. We've recognised the fact that in the three Gospels other than John, the three guys, Matthew, Mark and Luke, talk about miraculous works and miraculous signs. And they use the word dunamis, which means power. But when John talks about the miraculous signs, he actually refers to them in a different way. He talks about them as being miraculous signs, saying that there is something, recognizing, I guess, that there's something deeper than just a wow factor. These weren't just miraculous things that showed the people what Jesus was like, but also there were miraculous signs that pointed the way to God. So that's where we've been. We've looked at, if you were here a few weeks ago, we looked at, Graham did his talk on wine and how that came from some of the water. Colin talked brilliantly about healing from a distance. Janet talked about 5,000 families that were fed, which was excellent too. Then Pastor Graham talked about the blind man healed last week. And this morning then, we're going to talk about Lazarus. We're going to be thinking about John chapter 11. So if you would like, if you've got your Bibles and you want to follow, then why don't you head towards John chapter 11, which we'll read in a moment. But those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, and Janet was talking about feeding the 5,000, she had Tamsin to volunteer to come and chop up an apple while she talked. She chopped it into 120 pieces, and we all had a piece. And I was kind of inspired by that. And I thought, well, you know, my story is Lazarus. So what I really need is someone who will come and die for me. Just to, you know, help the illustration. And I was talking to John Mills. Those of you who know John, he's an ambulance man. And we discussed the possibility of him bringing a defibrillator. I think that's this morning. But unfortunately, John is on a shift, so he's listening to the podcast later. Hi, John. I'm afraid we haven't got one of those this morning. Otherwise, that's kind of the closest thing. If you haven't got the miracle, then the defibrillator is the next best thing, isn't it? So just need a little someone to help me with an example. Who have we got? Sam? Do you want to do that for us? So let's just have a round of applause for Sam for a moment. And Katie and Amy will help just prepare Sam for a moment. So, Sam, you're happy to die for me this morning? Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. You're a good man. So don't do too much, but if you start with his head and do his hands and his feet, that'll be good. Just helps us a little bit, doesn't it? Christine's wanted to do this for a while, I think, but we're not doing that this morning. That's a different morning. So this will help. This I'm hoping will help us a little bit as Sam undergoes this course of treatment. And we will need, you'll need your imagination hats on. One of the things that Janet was saying is when she was reading the story of the feeding of the 5,000, it's so easy with these stories that we know, particularly with this story of Lazarus. Most of you, probably all of you, know the ending where, of course, Lazarus lives. But in order for us to benefit the most from this story, we need to be thinking, try and get your heads for a moment, step out of the fact that you know the end of the story, and just imagine what it was like to be walking in the disciples' shoes, to be walking in Mary and Martha's shoes, and to discover exactly what they were thinking while this story of Lazarus unfolds and unwraps a little bit. That's looking good. Brilliant. Right, so while that's just finishing off, let's read together John chapter 11. I'm going to read a big chunk of it, if that's okay. And if it's not, I'm still going to read a big chunk of it. Okay, so I'm reading from the New Living Translation. Thank you very much. Perfect. That's a great job. You all right, Sam? Hang on, you're dead. You can't talk. Okay, that was just a test. Just let us know if, well, don't do anything. That's perfect. That's exactly what I was after. A man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. This is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick, so the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling them, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. When Jesus heard about it, he said, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. So, although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Finally, he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. But his disciples objected, Rabbi, they said, only a few days ago the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again? Jesus replied, there are 12 hours of daylight every day. During the day, people can walk safely. They can see because they have the light of this world. But at night, there is danger of stumbling because they have no light. Then he said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but now I will go and wake him up. The disciples said, Lord, if he is sleeping, he will soon get better. They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant Lazarus had died. So he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there, for now you will really believe. Come, let's go see him. Thomas, nicknamed the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let's go too and die with Jesus. When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in the grave for 4 days. Bethany was only a few miles down the road from Jerusalem, and many of the people had come to console Martha and Mary in their loss. When Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, but Mary stayed in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. Jesus told her, your brother will rise again. Yes, Martha said, he will rise when everyone else rises at the last day. Jesus told her, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Yes, Lord, she told him. I've always believed you're the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who's come into the world from God. Then she returned to Mary. She called Mary aside from the mourners and told her, the teacher's here and wants to see you. So Mary immediately went to him. Jesus had stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. When the people who were there at the house consoling Mary, saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus' grave to weep. So they followed her there. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. Where have you put him? He asked them. They told him, Lord, come and see. Then Jesus wept. The people who were standing nearby said, see how much he loved him. But some said, this man healed a blind man. Couldn't he have kept Lazarus from dying? Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. Roll the stone aside, Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, protested, Lord, he's been there for 4 days. The smell will be terrible. Jesus responded, didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe? So they rolled the stone aside. Then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me, but I said it aloud for the sake of all these people standing here, so that they will believe you sent me. Then Jesus shouted, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. Jesus told them, unwrap him and let him go. Many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. Okay, so it's a pretty amazing story, isn't it? And the goings-on up until that point, just to put us in the context, Jesus and the disciples have been in Jerusalem, and it's fair to say there's quite a bit of tension. Jesus has told the people that he is the Son of God, and of course this was a statement where the punishment was stoning. And so they've suggested to Jesus that they were going to do that. Then they were going to arrest him. And the Bible's not particularly clear. I don't know about you. There's some bits where I think it's helpful. I've got a study Bible and there's some notes, but there's still parts that we don't understand. The bit just before that sets the context to where we're at today says, once again, they tried to arrest him, but he got away and left them. And I'd like to kind of know a bit more, you know, is Jesus, you know, able to disappear? Did he hide? Did he, you know, how did he, if they wanted to arrest him, surely they could have arrested him. See, I don't know quite. But anyway, this is where we're at. With Jesus and the disciples have moved on from where they've been because there's so much tension in this place. They've gone somewhere that's safer. And they're further away now from the family, from Lazarus, Martha and Mary. And then we hit chapter 11. And we'll just walk through some of this. And what I want you to do is just to try and, as I say, imagine a little bit what it was like to walk through the disciples' shoes, to think about how Mary and Martha felt. So, what have we got? Lazarus becomes sick. We don't exactly know what with, but we know that it doesn't look good. And Mary and Martha have a dilemma, don't they? Because they've seen Jesus perform these miracles. They know what he can do. And yet they're also aware that if they send a message to Jesus saying, Jesus, come and help us, Lazarus is in trouble, they know that there is a real risk that actually they could be inviting Jesus back into this place of tension, into this place of trouble, and even the risk of death. But in the end, they decide, yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to send a message to Jesus. And of course, they can't text him. They can't put a message on his Facebook page. It'd be interesting to know how many friends Jesus would have had on his Facebook page, wouldn't it? But they can't do that, of course, so they have to send a message. And the way the maths works out, it's likely that the message would take about a day to reach Jesus. So Jesus is told about this, he hears the news, and he doesn't seem surprised. He's not fazed by it, but he says, okay, well, we're not going to go. And you get the impression that the disciples are thinking, good news, Jesus. You know, we know you like Lazarus. We know you must have been tempted to go back and help him out, but it's the right decision because there's a lot of trouble back there. We're only going to get into a whole lot of hot water again. Some of the things that you say, Jesus, as well, don't really help. So let's stay here. You've made the right decision. Then 2 days later, Jesus turns around and says, ah, okay, now is the time that we go. And the disciples, you can imagine, can't you? They say, Jesus, it's only a few days ago, but surely you haven't forgotten the trouble that we faced back in Judea. Let's not do that. You know, I know normally you get things right. Normally you're pretty good on the whole wisdom front, but this really is not a good idea. And Jesus says, look, it's all right. If it's daylight and you've got the light of the world with you, it's going to be okay. It is going to be okay. And the disciples look at each other and he says, and after all, I'm just going to wake up Lazarus. And the disciples go, oh, crikey, you know, here we are again. He's going to go and wake up Lazarus. Listen, Jesus, we don't need to do that. You've got this messenger. Send him back. Ask him to wake him up. Everything will be all right. And Jesus says, no, no, no. And, of course, in those days, using the language of he's only sleeping was normal. They used to refer to people who died as sleeping. So Jesus was using the kind of the normal language of the day. But he has to make it clear to them. And he says, no, guys, he's actually dead. But don't worry, it's good news, because after this, you're actually going to, you will believe a lot better. And so actually, you know, there is some good that's going to come out of all this. And then John records this little section, doesn't he, about Thomas. And this was the bit, I don't know if you smiled a little bit when we got this Thomas bit. This is John with a little side note. Now, why does John refer to Thomas here? I think when I first read it, so what does Thomas... Let's just say, what does Thomas say? He says, let's go to with Jesus. Let's go to and die with Jesus. And when I first read that, I thought, oh no, this is, you know, poor old Thomas. He's already got, you know, if there's a marketing campaign for the disciples, Thomas has already got the T-shirt that says Doubting Thomas on it, hasn't he? You know, you get a pack of 12, well, probably a pack of 11, because there probably isn't a lot of people who want to wear the Judas one. But you've got a marketing thing. You've got a pack of 12, a pack of 11 T-shirts. There's the one with Thomas on that says Doubting Thomas. And then now we add to it, not only is he a Doubting Thomas, but he's also Mr. Negative as well. So, you know, he pipes up, oh, come on, everyone. Let's go with Jesus. We might as well. We'll all get killed. But, you know, hang on. And that's the way I kind of read it. So, but actually, I think if you look at what he's saying, the disciples were they were genuinely aware that there was the possibility that going with Jesus back to Judea meant that they might end up dying. And so actually, I think the reason that John does put this in is not because Thomas was negative, but actually because he's pointing out that there's actually a lot to be commended and applauded about the way that Thomas was reacting to what Jesus had said. Actually, you can read it both ways, but I think that Thomas was saying, guys, come on, let's go with Jesus. Jesus had talked about taking up your cross and following him. I think Thomas was actually putting this into practice. So I think we give Thomas a round of applause here, and we say, well done, Thomas. Some of the disciples make some big blunders, don't they? But I think at this point, Thomas is doing all right. So that's a bit of a side note. And then we move on to Bethany. Okay, so the scene has changed. We've arrived back in Bethany. Jesus and the disciples have made the way there. And when they get there, they find out the news. I'm sorry, Jesus, Lazarus has been dead now for 4 days. And the 4 days is significant because in those times, in those days, there was this kind of feeling that after 3 days, the soul might not have left the body. So there was still the possibility that he could be resuscitated. So John is not just, he's interested in the details, but also this will be very pertinent to the disciples, because if it was 4 days, then no one would really have any debate about whether or not Lazarus was really dead. And at this point, I mean, you can see, I think Graham referred to it last week, the fact that John paints such an intimate picture here. And, you know, if you get in your imagination how the emotion that must have been around at this time. Martha is obviously aware her brother has died. It's easy to forget exactly how she must be feeling when all this is going on. She rushes out to Jesus, and you can imagine that whether is she reprimanding him, or is she asking the question, or is she just displaying her own faith when she says, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And I don't know about you. I don't know how would we respond if we were in that situation? Would we come to Jesus and tell him off? Would we come and, you know, beat him up a little bit? You know, Jesus, I thought you were my mate. You know, you could have done something about this. But actually, she doesn't, does she? She says, when they have this conversation, she says, Jesus, I still believe in you. I know that even though this hasn't worked out how I wanted to, she makes that statement of faith. You are God. You and God are still one in the same. And actually, you know, Martha, in the midst of this awful nightmare situation, of course, she doesn't know the outcome, so this is bad news, isn't it? A brother has died, Jesus could have helped. But she makes this amazing statement of faith, saying that she knows that Jesus is still who he said he was. And at this point, they have the conversation, and you can see that Martha is struggling, and the answers that she makes are kind of skirting around the issues a little bit. Jesus is saying he's going to rise again, and she says, well, yeah, I know everyone's going to rise again, aren't they? And Jesus says, no, look, you know, he is going to literally rise again. And he says, do you believe that? And she just displays a great example of faith, I think. And then we don't get the miracle yet straight away, but arguably this is the most important message of the story. It's kind of, you know, the whole chapter is about life from death, isn't it? And Jesus makes this statement right in the middle of all of this. You can, it's just amazing, isn't it, how Jesus uses all the circumstances, all the situations. And this is why it's a sign. Jesus has got the perfect platform to make this statement. So Jesus told her, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. And of course, he's referring to Lazarus, but he's making this central statement, which is central to our faith, isn't it? Central to our belief. The fact that although this is one set of circumstances, he's reaching forward, he's looking into the future, and he's making this amazing statement that actually has an eternal perspective on it. And it's part of our inheritance, it's part of our message, it's part of the good news that we have still today. We talked a bit about this morning about the message that we have for our friends and our neighbours, haven't we? And this is the crux of it, isn't it? The fact that Jesus said, I'm the right. Anyone who believes in me, you believe in me, and you will never die. We've got this eternal perspective, which is good news, isn't it? Good. Okay, and then we have Mary and all the crying. Now, we have a reference to it here, but again, this is something where you need your imagination hats on, because in those days, it was the practice as part of the culture to have all this crying and wailing going on, okay? If you were really rich, you would hire in, you'd have a rent-a-whale crowd, W-A-I-L, not W-H-A-L. And you'd rent these people. And if you're really rich, you'd have a massive crowd. They'd make a lot of noise. There'd be a lot of, you know, it'd be very noisy, grieving time. I'm not sure it would particularly help me, but this was the norm. This is what was going on here. So Jesus arrives. He's spoken to Martha. Then he talks to Mary. And they're in the midst of this noisy wailing. And Mary comes out. And she reiterates the same facts that Martha has already said. She said, Jesus, if you'd have been around, everything would have been a lot better. And at this moment, again, a highly emotional point of the story, we see that Jesus is deeply troubled. And you look at this and you kind of think, well, perhaps Jesus was upset. We know that he was Lazarus's friend. But I don't think he gets caught up in that. If you read it carefully and you look back and I've been reading some of the other things that other people have said about this passage, because it seems kind of confusing. What was Jesus angry about? He's just talked to Martha and he said, look, he's going to rise from the dead. And at first I thought, well, perhaps Jesus is angry because of the lack of faith. Perhaps he's not sure. He's angry. Why aren't they believing what he's saying? But actually, the reason that Jesus is angry is because he sees, I think he's angry at death itself and this reign of terror that death is causing. Jesus is only a few steps away. The story that's coming up is when he's going to die and rise again, and he's going to defeat death ultimately. And at this point, I get the impression that there's this whole scene, there's all the wailing, there's all the noise, and Jesus becomes angry because he sees the way that death has got a grip on this situation. And that's why the Bible says that that he was deeply disturbed. And I think some of the translations go even further than that, and talking about the way that Jesus was disturbed by what he was seeing, the anger. And then we get the shortest verse in the Bible. Good for the pub quiz. The shortest verse, of course, is where it just says simply, Jesus wept. And again, you know, when you read this, you wonder, you know, what was in Jesus's makeup at the point of why was Jesus weeping? Of course, he was empathizing with his friends, but it's quite clear that Jesus wasn't in the wailing. Jesus just wept passionately, seeing that his friends were grieving the way that they were. And I got this quote from somewhere. It says, "The love of God for us and his wrath towards that which corrupts and destroys are two sides of a single coin." And I love that on the one hand you've got Jesus' anger, and on the other side you've got him weeping. You know, his anger for the situation, his anger for the way that death has got his grip on this situation, and yet you've got the weeping and the compassion for his friends as well. And then, of course, it's time for the miracle. And at this point, we know what's coming next, and it's only a couple of verses. But if you imagine for the disciples, you know, what are they thinking at this point in time? You know, Jesus has got this brainwave. He's going to roll back the stone, and everybody around is, you know, looking at each other and thinking, well, you know, we've seen him do some pretty amazing things. We've seen some pretty good stuff that's been going on, and these signs do seem to crop up when Jesus is around. But rolling back the stone, Jesus, do you know? You know, if this doesn't work out, this is going to be a major boo-boo on your CV. You know, it's kind of, and everybody's thinking it, but is it Mary or Martha? One of them pipes up and says, Jesus, you know, the smell will be really terrible. And I did a bit of investigation as to what the worst smells are. I just did a quick, you know, Google search, Ala Colin, and decaying flesh really does rank pretty high in terms of the nasty smells. The other one, of course, is milk. I had the other week when we went to Cliff College. We took, how many pints of milk did we take with us to Cliff College? come on, 4:59. Sorry, about 80 pints, and four of them chose to stay in the boot of my car because of so my car probably wasn't on a par with decaying flesh, but my car was not a pleasant place to be. And I was in America once, I was with a friend, and we were just he was driving me through the I don't think we're in the country, we're in a town, and this small animal. I didn't really see it because we were going not too fast, but we were going fast. This small animal kind of ran out from the side of the road, and you felt a kind of bumping and a kind of a thud. And and in the wing mirror, you could see something. We'd hit something, and I said to the guy, "I said, oh no, what was that?" It was kind of I'd never really seen. Apparently, it was a skunk. So at the time, there was no effect, but this skunk had done its thing on the underside of the car. So, and you know when you see the cartoon of the skunk that jumps around and you kind of think, well, perhaps it's a kind of a nasty, whiffy kind of... But actually, it's this real putrid. It's kind of an acid-y kind of smell. And I don't know how, but it just pervaded the whole of the car. So every time you got in the car, if it was raining, you had to wind the windows down and put your head out of it. And the great thing was, I think he just picked me up from the... I don't know where, from the airport or something. My bag with all my clothes was in the boot, and this incredible smell was able to just soak into everything. So, I don't know why I was telling you that. Anyway, so nasty smells, decaying flesh. Mary and Martha are pretty convinced that rolling the stone back is not going to be a good idea, and the disciples too are thinking, you know, what is Jesus doing? And it's easy for us, isn't it? Because we know the story, we know the outcome. But if you put yourself in their place, then there's a really, you know, they just don't know what is going to happen. They don't know the outcome. And then, of course, Jesus says, and here comes, this is the signpost, isn't it? Here's the signpost. Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me. But I said it out loud for the sake of the people, so that they will believe. So the reason for the miracle, so that people will believe. So that we'll have faith, not just the wow factor, but so that we'll believe. And then, of course, we know what happens. It says, Lazarus, come out. And here he is, Lazarus. He's alive. Thanks, Sam. You can take all that with you, or actually, I'll keep that because we can reuse that. We can reuse this at home, can't we? Okay, so it's a great story, and after I've been reading this week, I get two questions. Matt, could you just put the first question up? In fact, that's not the question. That's what we've just been talking about. So. Good. So, yeah, so there's two questions that I've been thinking. So, from this passage, always a good question to ask when Jesus is involved. What can we learn? What do we see? So, just push these on for me, Matt, and I think we've seen these anyway. But the first thing that hit me was that Jesus is always in control. He wasn't under pressure to change his mind. He wasn't under pressure to go and find, to help Lazarus. He knew his plan. He knew what he was going to do. He's always in tune with the Father. It's so clear, isn't it? So many occasions, but here particularly, that Jesus and his Father are so in tune with each other. Hugely passionate and emotional. We just talked about it, but he's not the meek and mild Jesus from the stable. There's a real passion and an emotion. We hit that at various points in the Gospels, but particularly here. Comfortable in uncomfortable and potentially very smelly situations. You know, this Jesus isn't freaked. He's not panicked by what, where could he be? And it's interesting to me. You don't see it, but you know, here is the setting for a miracle. And I don't know about you, but if I was going to set up the miracle, I'd have done things a little bit differently. I'd have, you know, perhaps created a nicer environment in which to operate. But Jesus is, you know, he's right in the midst of that. This is where the rubber hits the road. Okay, this is what's going to happen in a difficult situation. I think there was there one more? Yeah, last one, always ready. to give God the glory. Okay, so that's my question in terms of what we learn about Jesus. Then my second question, and I guess this is the challenge of, we've had this challenge really already this morning, so it's not so much my question, it's the question for the day, coming back from the things that we've already talked about. But if I ask you that this morning, where do you stand on this whole issue of miracles today? And even, you know, the issue of raising people from the dead. We're going to be asked our views, aren't we, in a few weeks and months on the politics in our nation. And so today, this has nothing to do with the politics, but I'm asking you the question, where do you stand? So a few more questions this morning. Right, you ready? How many believe that this story that we've read this morning, John chapter 11, is true? Okay, how many people believe that God is still in the business of miracles in the world today? How many people believe that if the person sitting next to you requires some form of healing this morning, that God is able to do it? How many people would like, change the question a little bit, how many people would like to see water turned into wine? A lot of people save on the shopping bill. How many people would like to see how many people would like to see, you know how a lot of people have one leg shorter than the other? How many people would like to see God do something miraculous and see someone's leg grow so it was the same? Yeah. And how many people would like to see someone raised from the dead? Yeah, I think I do. So, I mean, if they're the things we want to see, why would God want to do miracles today? Why would God be interested in miracles today? Because, of course, there are some people who believe that all this stuff that we read in the Bible was only for then, it's not for now. One definition of the word miracle, a remarkable and welcome event that seems impossible to explain. We've already sung it this morning. Impossible, what was it? Impossible for you, something like that. I'm not so good on the words. Are there miracles? Another question I was thinking, are there miracles taking place around us that we're not aware of? Probably. Does God have to work a bit harder to raise someone from the dead? We've done it in our series, haven't you? There's been a progression in these miraculous signs. And I was thinking about it, you know, yes, there is a progression, but is water into wine, is that the kind of, you know, that's the miracle for beginners? And then you work your way up, and finally, you know, if you've mastered it, you've got the ultimate miracle is, you know, raising someone else from the dead, and then a couple of weeks' time, you know, even more tricky, raise yourself from the dead. But it's not like that, is it? If it is a miracle, then a miracle is a miracle. You know, you can't have the difficult end of the spectrum. A miracle is a miracle. I asked myself the same challenging question this morning, because it is a challenge, isn't it? I can put my hand up and say, yeah, I believe that God raises people from the dead. But at some point, me putting my hand up has got to actually enact itself out in reality, hasn't it? It's got to make a difference. It's got, you know, something's got to happen. If I really believe that, then if I've got the dead body here, you know, John was offering as well. John Mills, very, very, he's a good guy, as well as a defibrillator. He's offering to go to the morgue for me. You know, it's great to have friends, isn't it? And I was thinking back, as I was asking myself that question, I remembered the time when I was at university, which was a real time of faith, real time of expectation. Those of you who went to university, I don't know if you had a similar experience, but it was one of those kind of things. Me and my friends in the Christian Union, yeah, we're ready to take the world by storm, and we'll start with the 25,000 students, but then we'll go further beyond that. And I had some great friends at university, and one of them was this girl called Jo. She's an amazing woman of God. In fact, she came and she did some stuff with us. She's brilliant, Jo, and she got married, and she's called Jo Saxon now, which really helped me because I couldn't pronounce her name before. It was something like Onyeranyeran or something. You know, Jo, didn't you, Jude? And she's this amazing woman. I could tell you some of the stories of the things that she did, the way that she heard God, and the way that she just responded to the things that God was saying. She'd just turn up on someone's doorstep because God told her to, and he directed her there, and she didn't know what she was going to say. And when she got there, she explained to this guy. She said, Matt, I was a bit nervous. I thought, well, good, because at least I can still be friends with you. she said, you know, I turned up on the doorstep, and this guy opened the door. I didn't know what I was going to say to him, and she said, do you mind if I come in? God's told me that I need to talk to you about something. And I don't think she told him at that point. She didn't know what, because I think that might have put him off. But she ended up going in, talking to this guy, and apparently he used to be a minister, and he'd given up on the whole thing. He said he couldn't do it anymore, and she said, I just believe that God wants you to know that he hasn't given up on you, and he's still got a lot of things for you to do in your life. And he kind of, well, you can imagine it kind of blows him away, and I can't remember the rest of the story. But this is my friend Jo, okay? This is the kind of thing she does. And I felt quite privileged that she would want to be friends with me, kind of thing, because I looked at it and she'd say, man, Matt, you are such a man of faith. And I'd go, yeah, right, you're kind of like, I don't do any of this kind of stuff. But she said to me, and I remember this was a high point in university, she looked at me and we were praying or we were doing something together in a meeting, and she said, Matt, one day we are going to see the dead raised. And I kind of thought, really, is that, but because she said it, I thought, yeah, I've got faith for that. And I just thought, you know, as I'm reminding myself of some of these stories this morning, I'm saying, well, where is my faith? And if I'm honest, I want to make sure that I don't have to go back to university to find the place of high faith in my life. I want to make sure that I'm moving forward. You've got a choice, haven't you? I think if I look at where I'm at today, there's a gap. I don't know if you can identify with this. There's a gap between where I am now in my faith and where I would like to be. And we've got a choice, haven't we? Either we move forward, we push into making that gap smaller, or we stay where we are. And, you know, there is a choice there, but on the other hand, there isn't really a choice, is there? Because we've got to move forward, haven't we? And that's why, I guess that's part of stepping up and stepping out. And it's easy, isn't it, to allow disappointments to hold you back. How easy is that? But, you know, how easy is it for us to allow the things that we've struggled with? You know, a couple of weeks ago, where I work, we dedicated a bench. People had given money, and not all of you will know, but some of you will know, a friend of mine, a colleague from work, Lee, in fact, most of you probably know, who, you know, died last September. And people had given money to Cancer UK, and also we felt it was right. So we dedicated this bench, which sits in the garden at work, and people can go and remember Lee. But if I'm honest, I didn't really want a bench, you know. And we were praying. We weren't praying for benches, were we? You know, we were praying that we would see the miracle that we believe that God had put before us. But God is still a God of miracles. That hasn't changed. And so we've got to move forward. We can't allow the disappointments to hold us back. I guess this morning, some of you are praying for miracles as well. We've already mentioned some of the things. That's why it fits so perfectly. You know, I guess there's things that we're all praying for in terms of miracles. I'm praying for, you know, we've prayed for Rich. It's Rich Hubbard, some of you will know. He's got this cancer in the gel, in the lining of his stomach. If you get to see him, he looks basically like he's pregnant. It's just massive, bulging. It looks awful. And his face is all drawn. And, you know, the only answer for him is a miracle, because this cancer is terminal. So it's tough, isn't it? We've got to pray for these miracles. Right, let's just read two more things and then I think we'll pray. I think it's another slide. Matt. Yeah, because if this is true, and I don't know about you, but I'm not sure what the things are that we're going to do that are greater than what Jesus did. But it kind of blows the whole thing wide open, doesn't it? If Jesus is saying, right, you're going to do these things, and you're going to do things greater. If I was sat next to him, I'd be saying, I'll just stick with whatever you've done, Jesus. This is fine for me. Yeah, that'll do. But Jesus, and actually, it's just a bit like Jesus, isn't it? Always pushing the boat a little bit further, pushing the boundaries a little bit further. And the reason, because Jesus went to the Father, the Holy Spirit came. We are, if this is true, and we have to kind of think it probably is because Jesus said it, then actually the horizons for us are pretty spectacular, aren't they? And we talked about this morning what we're after is Ashwood. And I guess I made the statement as I was thinking, I want Ashwood to be a community of faith that we challenge, help to challenge each other to believe for anything and to expect the miraculous signs to accompany the message that we have. Ephesians 3:20 says, now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us. Now, we pray to the God of the immeasurably more, don't we? Okay, if you just want to close your eyes, I'm just going to wrap up now, if that's okay. Some of you will have been reading Roy Todd's book, In Pursuit of the Miraculous, and he says this: I just saw God being himself, God. He's the source of miracles. His miraculous manifestations are not performances designed to impress, but a reflection of who he is. It's for this reason, more than any other, that we should expect signs and wonders to happen today. God is longing to reveal more and more of himself to us. It's when we have a deeper revelation of his greatness that we'll understand more of his power. It's not about seeing the bigness of the circumstance, but about having a vision of the Lord who's so much bigger than any problem or difficulty we can face in life. And he is for us, not against us. That's why there is every reason for us to believe for miracles today. Our God really is the God of miracles.